then other activities in the inlet are going to be restricted unnecessarily.
A federal plan to boost Cook Inlet beluga numbers is drawing sharp criticism from the state. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, January 4th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, a disagreement over natural gas from a city landfill could be settled by adding new housing units.
You've heard a lot about the Anchorage Bowl running out of land. North Anchorage and Iqaluit have a lot of that.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska Southeast is open for business to all Alaskans. 2017 is your year to finish a degree and increase your earning power with online courses in business, accounting, and management. Explore the options online at uas.alaska.edu/som. This message sponsored by UAS.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has released its final plan to increase the population of Cook Inlet's beluga whales and get them off the endangered species list. Biologists estimate there are now about 340 belugas in Cook Inlet, down from more than 1,000 in the 1980s. Researchers think the population dropped steeply in the 1990s because of unregulated subsistence hunting. But the whales haven't bounced back since hunting was curtailed in 1999. Mandy Murga of NOAA Fisheries says nobody knows why.
There is no clear explanation and no obvious single threat that is preventing this population's recovery. It's likely that it's a combination of multiple factors.
The recovery plan lists 10 potential threats, which should be limited, including noise from human activity in the inlet. But Bruce Dale, with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, says the plan's goals are either too vague or too difficult to measure, making it nearly impossible to get belugas off the endangered species list.
And when you have them unnecessarily on the list, then other activities in the inlet are going to be restricted unnecessarily.
That's activities like oil and gas development, coastal development, and commercial and recreational fishing. But the environmental group Cook Inlet Keeper says the plan doesn't go far enough, arguing that the fact that no one knows what's causing the decline is reason for more caution. They would like to see restrictions placed on industry activities that could be affecting the species. The Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly is standing behind their controversial invocation policy. At their Tuesday meeting, Assembly President Kelly Cooper introduced an amendment to the policy that would have allowed individuals who share a common interest or belief to be able to give the invocation. That amendment failed in a 6-3 vote. The American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska filed a lawsuit against the Kenai Peninsula Borough on December 14th over the issue. Under the current policy, only individuals or religious associations on a pre-approved list are allowed to give the invocation. The ACLU claims this violates constitutional rights to free speech and equal protection under the law. In preparation for the lawsuit, the Borough Assembly passed a resolution authorizing the transfer of $50,000 from the Borough Mayor's office to defend the policy in court. Late last month, the state's crime lab confirmed that a counterfeit prescription opioid tablet was found in Alaska. The small blue pill looked like a generic oxycodone tablet, but was actually made of the much stronger drug fentanyl. This is the first such pill to be found in the state, but they've been circulating in the lower 48 for over a year. The state's chief medical officer, Jay Butler, says people who buy drugs illegally may not be aware that they're getting such a powerful opioid and could more easily overdose when using it.
In general, use of illicitly obtained drugs is always going to be a game of Russian roulette.
Butler says people should seek treatment for their addictions, but if treatment isn't available and they continue using illegal drugs, they should be cautious.
Never use any kind of opioid medication alone. Always have someone around who will be able to help you if you overdose. Have naloxone available. That's the drug that can reverse the respiratory depression from opioid overdose. And avoid mixing drugs. Many people who die of an overdose have multiple drugs and alcohol on board at the time of death.
Butler says the state plans to start distributing naloxone to law enforcement agencies and health workers next week. The medication can be injected or administered through a nasal spray. The municipality of Anchorage has reached an agreement with a local native corporation, avoiding years of costly litigation. During a press conference today, leaders from both the city and Aklutna Incorporated shared details of the multi-part agreement. It includes promises of new housing stock, infrastructure, and cash for natural gas produced at the Anchorage landfill. Alaska Public Media's Zachariah Hughes reports.
Speaking before a wall-sized map of Dena'ina lands at the corporation's office in Eagle River, Aklutna Inc.'s CEO Curtis McQueen summed up the company's special relationship with the municipality.
We're all on the same page today. Aklutna thinks long-term. We've been a partner with the city for a lot longer than the last 45 years, for decades to come, and in our world, you could probably even say for centuries to come.
The for-profit ANCSA Corporation is the largest owner of private land within the municipality of Anchorage. It holds 90,000 acres, primarily within the thinly populated neighborhoods of North Anchorage, from Eagle River to Peters Creek. In the 80s, a federal agreement between Aklutna, the city, and the state resolved ownership issues over portions of North Anchorage lands, which includes the Anchorage landfill. In 2012, the city started capturing methane gas that's produced when garbage decomposes to sell, primarily for power generation, at nearby Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. A year later, Aklutna sued the city for selling that methane without sharing the revenues from it. Now, Berkowitz says the city and corporation have reached an agreement on that suit.
Aklutna is going to waive any future claims about gas. The municipality is going to forward about $5.75 million.
That money is a one-time payment, with $5 million coming from general government funds and another $750,000 paid by the local trash utility. But going forward, any money from gas sales at the dump will stay with the city. The payment is intended to help Aklutna build more than 100 residential units in the next 3 to 5 years. McQueen says housing construction is one of the corporation's proven abilities and was part of what they brought to the table when Aklutna began discussions around the lawsuit with the current administration.
You've heard a lot about the Anchorage Bowl running out of land. North Anchorage and Aklutna have a lot of that, but we have been part of many neighborhoods around Anchorage. And we've been talking about how to stimulate making more lots available.
The deal also lays out who will pay for infrastructure for the new developments. Anchorage's wastewater utility will front the cost for building sewer lines, though Aklutna will pay that money back. Speakers of the press conference stressed, however, that the agreement is worth more than the particulars of the settlement itself. Maria Coleman is on Aklutna's board of directors and says it's an accomplishment just for both parties to once again be working together in good faith.
It takes good hearts to get there, not just business.
The deal doesn't need approval from the Aklutna tribal government to go forward. Tribal Council President Lee Stefan was present at the press conference but declined to speak in an official capacity. Now, the measure is set to go before the Anchorage Assembly next week for approval. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, suicides spike in one of Alaska's poorest census areas.
130% increase is huge.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
The rate of suicide and homicide in the Kusilbak census area along the lower Yukon River more than doubled since 1980, an increase higher than anywhere in the nation. That's according to a study from the University of Washington that mapped how people in the U.S. died during those years. To better understand it, KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur talked with one of the study's designers and people in the region who are working to reverse the trend.
It's a sobering increase. From 51 deaths per 100,000 people in 1980 to 181 by 2014. While the finding from the University of Washington does come with some caveats, Dr. Abraham Flaxman, an assistant professor at the university in the Global Health Department, says it raises a red flag.
Let me start by saying 130% increase is huge. And anytime we see something like that and it's an increase in something bad, we want to know about that.
The data came from death certificates from across the nation. And using this source brings a potential defect to the study. Flaxman says death certification has been improving since the 1980s and quality varies. Also, in many areas, writing suicide on the certificate carried a stigma, so coroners would write something else. According to the state of Alaska's death statistics, since 1999, suicide in the Kusilvak area has far exceeded homicides. So, presumably, suicides account for most of the 130% increase. Flaxman hopes the numbers help local officials take action.
So now it is out there. And what happens from there, I really hope that this is something that people find helpful and can use to improve population health.
Suicides in Alaska Natives is no secret. In 2015, in the same census area, four people killed themselves in Hooper Bay in a period of weeks. One of the people trying to plug the flow of Alaska Native despair is Ray Daw, head of behavioral health at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation.
Our prevention department, which is about 4 years old, has done a lot of work at understanding the impact of boarding schools, the impact of the epidemics that occurred two generations ago upon families in the region.
All these forces from colonization disrupted the culture by killing whole families and communities with epidemics and then taking children away from the survivors to educate them in white-run schools. This led to family dysfunction and substance abuse, conditions ripe for suicide, because youth lose sight of a viable future. The YKHC Suicide Prevention Department works to reverse these forces by strengthening the Yupik culture. It bases its treatment on ways Yupik people lived healthy lives less than a century ago, before there was youth suicide. Daw says the department is fully staffed by local Alaska Natives who all speak Yupik.
Research says that, you know, if you're going to have effective work in behavioral health, you got to have people who are closer to the culture in terms of how they think, feel, and behave, and understand the dynamics of problems and solutions within that culture a lot more effectively than someone who isn't.
To get more Alaska Natives providing behavioral health care to Alaska Natives, the department partners with Dr. Diane McAkron at the UAF Kuskokwim University campus. Two Yupik elders are always in the classroom with McAkron. The classes work on how to counsel people and how to heal communities. McAkron is convinced these classes can make a real difference.
So we're looking at what does it mean for a whole community to experience more health and well-being? And if that happens, what are all the ways to help that happen? And then what outcomes can we imagine from that in terms of the rates of all these issues? Well, they would plummet.
Professionals are putting their hope in historical healing and resiliency, strengths the elders in the classroom embody, strengths the students work to build in their communities. The classes are rooted in understanding that the rates of suicide, domestic violence, and substance abuse are all ways colonization manifests when one culture violates another. From there, the students can move beyond the past to create a viable future.
That's a social condition that happened to the Yupik people. And that's a powerful insight for people to have, because now they can sit back and they can start to go, oh, it really wasn't us. So what is us that kept us safe before? And now let's get that.
But will it be enough to curb a trend that has built and increased over more than 30 years? No one knows the answer to that question. With help from Johanna Urick and Steve Heimel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel.
Fairbanks Interior Gas Utility is moving closer to inking a memorandum of understanding with the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority to acquire and merge operations with Fairbanks Natural Gas. IGU is gathering public feedback on the deal, which, as KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, would also expand the local distribution network.
Interior Gas Utility Chairman Mike Meeks says the utility and Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority are so close to finalizing an agreement, it's like a football sitting at the edge of the end zone. The only sticking point, he says, is how long Interior Gas Utility has to repay a loan. Meeks says the difference makes a modest annual bump to natural gas users' payments down the road.
We are now, after working for months on a $330 million project, we're now talking about $30 increase per resident 15 years from now.
Meeks outlined other financial points Tuesday night at a public meeting in Fairbanks City Hall. The deal has IGU purchasing Pentax, a company that includes Fairbanks Natural Gas. It would expand infrastructure, especially around North Pole, so more residents could tap into natural gas. But to make it a go, half of the target of borough households would have to convert to gas. Also, Meeks says, negotiations for a natural gas vendor are ongoing. Meeks's sense of urgency to finalize the deal were echoed by former borough mayor Lou Hopkins, who testified Tuesday.
Starting something like this, this far north, with some parts of it that have not been tied up in a nice neat package, I hope this accelerates it faster than it has been. It has been frustrating.
Another public meeting on the Memorandum of Understanding is scheduled on Thursday in Fairbanks Borough Chambers, and the Interior Gas Utility is set to vote on ratifying the agreement next week. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
In the U.S. House, Republicans started the new year with an awkward lurch. They proposed to weaken the Office of Congressional Ethics. Then they abandoned that effort after they were flooded with angry phone calls and President-elect Donald Trump took to Twitter to question their priorities. But not everyone agrees the House majority should have backed down. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, Alaska Congressman Don Young is among those who want the ethics office reined in.
Young missed the closed-door session Monday when his Republican colleagues proposed curtailing the independence of the ethics watchdog. Spokesman Matt Shukro says Young's flight to Washington was delayed. But Young was present for another Republican confab the next day, and Shukro says Young spoke up in favor of changes to the Office of Congressional Ethics.
He shared concerns that he thinks that reforms are needed for shortcomings within the office and having to do with due process, the rights to face your accusers.
Shukro says Young would have voted in favor of the changes to the ethics office if they hadn't been ditched before he had the chance. Among Young's objections, the spokesman said, is that the office can investigate a House member based on anonymous tips. The office was created in 2008 after a series of congressional scandals. Its staff reports to an independent board. They act something like a grand jury. If they find a case has merit, they refer it to the House Ethics Committee, which can punish the House member. One of the proposed changes would have put the Ethics Committee, composed of House members, in charge. Critics say it would weaken the ethics policing because House members aren't as inclined to hold their colleagues to account. Shukro said Young had a busy daily schedule and didn't have time to take questions on the subject himself.
Is his objection to the process of the way the office works now based on his own experience with the office?
I haven't asked him that question. I don't know the answer to that.
The Office of Congressional Ethics investigated Young in 2011 for how his legal defense fund was financed. 12 corporations, all owned by the Schwest family of the shipmaking firm Edison Schwest, each gave $5,000 contributions, the maximum allowed. The Ethics Committee concluded Young did nothing wrong, but they changed the rules to disallow contributions like that in the future. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. If subsistence is important to you, consider applying for a seat on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. The councils provide information and recommendations to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. Deadline to apply is Friday, February 3rd. Call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
November election results left more than half of U.S. states with authorized medical marijuana, and 8 of those allow recreational marijuana as well. So if pot helps some humans feel better, how about people's best friends? Pacific Northwest veterinarians are being asked about treating pets with cannabis. That puts them in a difficult spot legally. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonsi reports from Portland.
Hello.
Hi there.
Who's this?
This is Willie, and he is a 16-year-old Lhasa Shih Tzu.
Michelle Batten of Portland owns this small caramel-colored dog. She says Willie has a variety of age-related problems, including arthritis and anxiety from vision loss. Conventional painkillers made him sluggish.
So we started on the cannabinoid capsules.
Cannabidiol, better known as CBD, is derived in this case from hemp, the variety of the cannabis plant that's not mind-altering.
I was very open to it and so pleased with what I saw. Just, he's so much more content. He sleeps better. He's not in pain, and he doesn't have the anxiety.
Does it seem like the pets are getting high?
No, not at all. Just more calm.
Batten takes Willie and his 14-year-old sister to a clinic that advertises holistic pet care. Dr. Cornelia Wagner runs the Hawthorne Veterinary Clinic. She says pet owners turn to hemp or medical marijuana for many of the same things humans take it for these days, including cancer symptoms, pain, inflammation, seizures, nausea, chronic skin allergies, and loss of appetite.
So 5 years ago when I started here, hemp never came up, or cannabis hardly ever came up, but now we talk about it a lot.
Dr. Wagner tells dog owners that their animals are much more sensitive than humans to the effects of marijuana. It doesn't take much to cause a bad trip. Her clinic only stocks a few over-the-counter non-psychoactive hemp-based supplements, like the pills Willie the dog swallows twice a day.
We have them in capsule form.
Hemp for pets is largely unrestricted right now. Marijuana is different.
Legally, we have to be careful about it, even though recreational marijuana use is legal in Oregon now. As veterinarians, we are not allowed to prescribe it. So we have to be careful about giving recommendations.
The U.S. Food and Drug Administration on its website cautions against usage of marijuana products for pets. The FDA says the safety and effectiveness of these products has not been established and needs further study. The murky legal terrain got murkier this month when the Drug Enforcement Administration announced it considers all extracts from the cannabis plant to be controlled substances, including from hemp. The Oregon and Washington State Veterinary Medical Associations have posted their own cautionary fact sheets online. Olympia vet Dr. Lisa Parshley says she's hesitant about cannabis products, not just for legal reasons, but for the many scientific unknowns.
I just feel like everybody's trying to jump the gun and get into the use of this without doing due process in the research lab, in the clinics, and try to get a really good product out there that's safe and actually works.
Parshley says researchers need to verify health claims, delineate risks, and establish the proper dosing and delivery methods. Entrepreneurs in pot-friendly Western states aren't waiting, though, for the smoke to clear to meet consumer demand. Startups are selling a range of cannabis products for pets, from capsules, oils, butters, and tinctures to infused chew toys and dog treats. The FDA singled out 2 Western Washington companies last year. They received warning letters for allegedly selling unapproved new animal drugs. Then there's the separate issue of accidental marijuana exposure when pets eat their owner's stashes. That's rarely fatal, but can lead to the animal's hospitalization. I'm Tom Bonsi in Olympia.
Last week's big snowstorm improved trail conditions over a large swath of the interior, but not every area benefited. Organizers of the Copper Basin 300 sled dog race are still dealing with low snow, and as KUAC's Molly Rittig reports, that's altered the race route for the season's first big mid-distance event.
Mushers will see a lot of new terrain in the Copper Basin 300 this year, one of the top qualifiers for the Yukon Quest and Iditarod. While much of the interior received a huge gift of snow over the holidays, the Glen Allen area did not. In fact, some sections of the original course are still practically bare.
There's about a 15-mile stretch in there where there's only about 2 inches of snow.
Meg Jensen is on the board of the race, which starts in Glen Allen and makes a big loop through the wilderness between the Richardson and Glen Allen highways, stopping in roadhouses and backcountry checkpoints along the way. With the low snowpack east of the Richardson Highway, they decided to reroute it to the west side.
And there's a little vegetation stubble there, and it's not very good for dogs' feet.
That means about half the course will be run on new trails. While it was a lot of extra work for the groomers, Jensen said they're just happy to have a race this year.
You know, this has been a problem with Iditarod qualifiers in recent years. The snow conditions have been such that a lot have been canceled.
The 300-miler is good practice for the Yukon Quest and Iditarod because of the long distances between checkpoints and the wide variety of weather and terrain.
There's overflow, there's lake crossings, there's river crossings, there's places where the snow is blown off. It's just a little bit of everything.
Fairbanks was well represented last year, with mushers Matt Hall, Ryan Olson, Alan Moore, and Allie Zirkel all finishing in the top four. They'll all be back this year, too. The Copper Basin 300 starts January 14th at 10 a.m. in Glen Allen. In Fairbanks, I'm Molly Rettig.
Scientists say an ash cloud from a remote Alaska volcano that might have gone more than 6 miles into the atmosphere has dissipated after it was tracked north over the Bering Sea. Scientists at the Alaska Volcano Observatory issued its highest aviation alert for aircraft after the eruption late Tuesday of Bogoslav Volcano in the Aleutian Islands. The eruption was short-lived, lasting only a few minutes. Bogoslav has erupted several times in recent days. It's located about 850 miles southwest of Anchorage. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. With reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Rachel Waldholtz and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Sheila Farazan in Homer, Molly Rittig and Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, and Tom Bonsi in Portland. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a nice night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the 2017 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms available at bpteachers.com.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition, organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
The Alaska Public Radio Network builds bridges of communication between urban and rural Alaska. APRN, covering the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska